Hey, yo, what's up?
This is the OBGM.
And you are listening to CFRC 101.9
FM.
Good morning, Kingston and Queen's University. You're tuned in to CFRC 101.9 FM on this wonderful Thursday morning. It is now 11 a.m. And if this is your first time tuning in, welcome to Queen's, welcome to Kingston, and to CFRC Radio, your campus and community radio station here at Queen's. My name is Rue. I'm the host of the CFRC Live Sessions, a show where our team of volunteers brings you recorded musical sets and interviews with artists from around Kingston and beyond. Often we record these sets in our station's own Studio A. Sometimes we go out to venues and shows in town to record these sets, and we hope to bring you closer to the music and to the artists behind them each week in this 30-minute slot. If you'd like to get involved with the live sessions as a volunteer, maybe you'd like to take photographs and film, or record and mix the audio, get involved with the local scene and book bands around town for these sessions, including bands from Queens, or even host the live sessions and do these interviews, then please join us. We'll teach you how to do everything. Email livesessions@cfrc.ca or reach out to us on Instagram. Our handle is CFRC Live Sessions. Today we have a session with a Queens student band called Last Call. They dropped by the station to play a 3-song set and chat about their shows and their style of music just before the summer in April. They're now back in town and they're playing a show at the Mansion on September the 13th, so that's next weekend, with fellow Queens bands Naked by Nine and LHRK, and you can find details and tickets on their Instagram, which is the band Last Call. Keep up with our live sessions weekly on Instagram. You can find us again on CFRC Live Sessions. And you can also find us on YouTube to watch some fully filmed live sets. Of course, you can reach out to us if you'd like to do a session with us in the future as well. Now, here comes Last Call's CFRC Live Session. Enjoy! Right. Good morning, folks. You're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM, CFRC.ca. It's 11 a.m. You're tuned into the live sessions or watching this on the YouTube later on. I'm your host, Rue, and we're joined today by, I think, the biggest band we've had in this semester. And you can interpret biggest however you want, but there are seven-piece. There are seven-piece. And Last Call are joining me today. Hello, guys.
Hey.
We're all feeling really pumped up over here. I mean, we're talking to you fresh off the back of Ailapalooza, which, I mean, huge deal. Let's introduce you to guys to people who are listening in and who are like, who were that first band? You know, the guys who came up front. Because a lot of people did tell me, oh my gosh, that first band was really good. So let's introduce you.
Okay, I'm Skylar. I sing.
I'm Ellie. I also sing.
I'm Claire, I play guitar.
I'm Sinead, I play bass.
I'm Nick, I play sax and drums.
I'm Leo, I play drums.
I'm Brendan, I play the lead guitar.
You guys, I mean, we were talking about Ailapalooza and everything, which has kind of been like the pinnacle of your semester, of your year. But to take it back a little bit for our listeners, we have to talk about the backstory, because, like, correct me if I'm wrong, but, like, you guys kind of showed up on the scene at the Mansion Battle of the Bands, which was to decide who was going to be the opening band at Ailapalooza. And you'd played like one or two shows before that, but it was the first time you were playing together as a band on stage, like all of you and not just like two people at Miziki.
I think that was all of our first, well, it was our first show as Last Call. Mm-hmm. It was also our first show like knowing each other in general, I think.
Yeah, really?
Yeah, we formed like 2-3 weeks before.
Yeah. Maybe? I think, yeah.
Because we had to like try out to get into the actual thing.
Auditions.
Yeah, we had auditions. I think it was like 2 weeks before auditions be formed, and we kind of did it on like on a whim of like, hey, this will be really cool. It was just a fun practice.
We did not think we were going to make it through the auditions at all.
I did. I didn't think we were that bad.
Who started Last Call then? Or who was the first person who went, I'm going to hold auditions, I'm already in the band?
I think we have to give credit to Skylar here. A lot of us met through like Queen's Music Club, and we would go to the jam sessions. And yeah, I feel like Skylar came in right from the start of the school year, just like, I want to start a band, and was just super welcoming and just like, yeah, reached out to all of us. And anyway,
how
you continue.
How it really happened was last year I met Nick at QMC, and I was like, you're really good at drums. Next year we should start a band. And he was like, sure, text me next year. So I did. And then the rest of it really fell into place. Like, what do you remember?
I don't know. Leo and Sinead and Brendan all showed up to jam club just one day, coincidentally.
And then Brendan was like, oh, I saw Claire at one of the jams. We should ask her. And then, yeah, everybody just kind of, it just kind of formed really organically.
Were you at the rock or the pop jams?
The rock jams.
Pop jam? Both.
I remember going to both.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like we can hear a good mix of both, really, in like the music you play and the way you guys play it as well. But coming back to that mansion show, like a lot of bands were kind of established bands who had like done it last year. I feel like at least two or three of them had done the Battle of the Bands last year as well. And so they kind of knew what was happening, and like they also had experienced the three-way tie that had happened last year. So like, kind of, people were a little bit tense in spite of everything. How were you guys, if you can remember now, feeling at that time, like going into that show, first show and everything?
I think like we were kind of just doing it for the fun of it, you know, like mm-hmm. we weren't expect, or at least I like wasn't expecting us to win at all. Mm-hmm. Like I think Leo had like was like walking his sister home, like yeah, he was like he had like left.
I had fully left. I was like after the show, like my sister, she had come up for the show and then she needed to go home and just like head to bed, and I was like, hey, I'll walk her home, I'll see you guys after. And I got a text on the way home, I was like, hey, we've won. I was like, what?
There was a picture of us afterwards and it's everybody like with crazy faces, we're all like, oh my god, and Leo's just not in it.
I was celebrating at home, I was very excited.
You were there in spirit.
Indeed it was.
Hey, I do remember like I kind of spoke to one of you guys at least after the show, and you were just like rabbit caught in headlights, like, oh my god, that happened.
Yeah. I mean, it was really seriously like, I think our first picture of us together in like practicing was I think September 16th or something, and then what Battle of the Bands auditions was within like 3 weeks of that, and then the show was right after that. It all happened very quickly.
Yeah. And how are you planning for a show like that? I mean, with a Battle of the Bands is a little bit different to a normal show where you kind of have to like put on your best, like we're showy band thing and like impress the crowd and everything, because it's an audience vote, right? Yeah. And like, obviously you guys went for it. You know, had all the kind of like rock moves and everything too. But how much of that was intentional, and how much of it was just like you discovered yourself on stage?
It was really difficult because we were just trying to get enough songs to be able to play the set for Battle of the Band. And right after the reading week, so we were all home, and like we weren't able to practice together for a full week too, so we kind of went our own ways, just came back together hoping for the best, right? And whatever happened on stage, I don't know, it just kind of was instinct, I guess.
Yeah, that's the best you can hope for, really. And you guys perform covers, and that's kind of been your thing going forward and playing other shows as well. But I feel like even through that, especially now, there's a sense of a Last Call sound that's starting to emerge. So I just want to know a bit about like the evolution of the sound, because obviously like you're playing a lot of songs that might have been written by like four guys in a room, but you've got two singers doing it, you've got sax being added to it, you've got two guitars and everything. I feel like it kind of brings your own sound about. Have you found that you're finding your own kind of musical voice now?
That's a tough question. I don't know. I mean, I think something that's really interesting about having seven people in a band is that it takes a while to agree on what songs to do in
for
general.
Sure.
And I think part of what makes us like a little more versatile, if you will, is like literally we just all sit in a room and go, okay, what do you think of this song? And we all go yes or no. So everybody is coming in with a very different music taste, I think. And I don't know.
Just pick great songs from that.
Yeah.
Music taste and, like, I don't know, experience that they're bringing to the table just in the way they play. And, I mean, everybody's got a style. And, like, I mean, like you said, part of the songs, like, that we play, some of them really are just a lot more emptier in the sound. And
I think Nick deserves some credit, too, on the sax. Like, I think when we played Battle of the Bands, we only had you on sax for a few songs because we didn't even really no, you could do it at that point. But I think that also brings like a really cool feeling to the music we do and changes the sound of a lot of songs when you add sax to it.
And we've been talking about kind of the covers that you've been playing. You're going to play one for us to begin with. So let's tell people what you're playing and tell me why you picked this particular song. Like, how did it work its way into your set list?
I think this was my choice, Julia by Mount Joy. Mm-hmm. I heard it, and I knew that Nick played sax, and I just kind of heard the vision, I would say, right? Like, this song could definitely have more, right?
Yeah.
And Nick I know he crushes it on sax. Yeah. So
I think that's one of at least one of my favorites that we do, and it's one we've been doing like since our first show, one of the first songs we got down good. So
it's true. I think it was really cool that we got to play it at Battle of the Bands and play it at Ale. It was also something that Queen's Journal wrote about, like how they really liked the sax. So it was a highlight of Ale. So the sax.
If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Yeah,
you gave it a really nice like R&B touch as well. Just like, you know, you made it that sound, that song that you can like have in the middle of the set and just like pace out your set a bit more.
Yeah.
But we're going to be starting with it. So we'll have Last Call here playing Julia on CFRC Radio.
Sweater, fix my spine, step up in line. I'm ordering food high, and I don't know why I'm so nervous. I'll make it, cause that's my favorite waitress. Those big brown eyes, I don't know what I order. Smiling like I can't afford it. Ooh. Waiting for liftoff, I don't know, I was too immersed, cause I just lost my mind in the fluorescent lights of my life, in my mind, the wheel for running free like rabbits, but Julia, Spanish moss, sudden heat, the silver moon in the trees, and the devil's in my bloodstream. Don't say you love the old me.
Last Call, and you just heard our cover of Julia by Mountjoy.
Welcome back. You're listening to CFRC Live Sessions on CFRC Radio, and we're joined by Last Call, and we were talking about live shows with you guys. You've obviously played one of the biggest live shows. I mean, like, for a lot of bands, within the first year, you're not often playing out, like, sold-out crowds to, like, 500, 600 people, right? So it's a big moment, and, like, we caught up with you guys backstage before the show as well, but you're kind of on the other side of it now. So you've maybe had, like, a day to look back on it all. How is that show, like, settling in your minds right now?
I think it still feels kind of surreal, like, looking back. It was just incredible to be up there, and definitely a different stage, like at Ale, just looking out at the crowd and being kind of a little bit like higher up. So that was definitely like a new experience. And yeah, just really, really incredible and a great way to kind of end off the semester together.
I think so too.
Also, not being on top of each other was kind of crazy. Yeah, like being able to like spread out and like be on this big stage was so cool. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna say too. Like we finally had like a lot of space to like express ourselves as a band and really like show what we have to like. I'm not like 500 people were gonna pull up there, but it was. I'm really glad they did, and I hope like we impressed them. And I think we did. I think we killed it.
I think so too. I think we left feeling very happy with what we put out.
Job well done.
I feel like, you know, even when with Battle of the Bands, we just tried to show up and do our best, and I feel like we've been able to continue just showing up and doing our best, like just trying, you know.
And I feel like a venue that's that big, it kind of makes sense as well, where you're like filling out the bass with like a little bit of sax as well, and then you get this bigger sound. Because like I remember just standing in the crowd, and obviously your songs were like really upbeat and like people were dancing in the crowd, but it was also just like really powerful sounding because like you had so much music coming through, right? Like that was the stage for a 7-piece.
It was very echoey. It was a little scary at first. But
also I want to talk about the looks, because like you've told us behind the scenes that you have a group chat for preparing for this. So of course we've got to ask you about it on air as well. What is the last call look, and what do you guys like discuss when you're getting ready for shows? Like what are you trying to show people?
We've done colors in the past, but usually I just say look cool and awesome, and everyone does what they do, and we always just end up looking kind of cohesive, so yeah.
We also had a hair tinseling night courtesy of Ellie right before, so we had that going for us. Yeah.
Oh yeah, I remember that. Yeah, we've got evidence it's still here. Yeah. That's how fresh off of Ailapalooza we're talking.
I think we always try to go with like some sort of cohesive look, but we also like recognize we are like we're a band, but we're also individuals. So we it's never like we need to all look the same. We all just try to kind of wear what we feel comfortable in.
Yeah, and I feel like it gives you room, like you were saying, to express yourselves a little bit, and that's where you get a little bit of like what I was calling the last call sound, because everyone's bringing a bit of themselves to this. So have you guys like started thinking about maybe like recording music or writing stuff as Last Call?
Absolutely. Yeah. That's definitely, we've been talking about that a lot, especially this summer. You know, we'll all be kind of different places, different jobs and so what, but yeah, we definitely are hoping to do some songwriting all together this summer and continue searching for that sound.
Yeah. And we're hoping that we can like create something that still brings the Last Call energy in, but with our own music this time.
I think recording our own or writing our own stuff at least was a thought like right away. There was a minute there where we were trying to work on something, but we got some really cool opportunities for shows, and then we had to put the originals on the back burner for a little bit. But this summer, like you said, we're all going to be all over the place and hopefully be able to come together in September with some cool stuff.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, it's a big deal for a band to, like, in the first year have stuff written anyway. So if you guys are already thinking about it, that's a pretty big deal, like, to begin with. But like we were saying, your covers are almost their own versions. Like, I remember at Ailapalooza, you started off with this Kings of Leon song, and, like, it took me a while to even realize which song it was, and then it struck me and it was like, oh, because you were kind of doing it your own way. And our second song that we're going to be listening to you guys playing is also something a bit like that. Like, you've kind of made this song your own. It's a song that I've heard a bunch of different bands cover as well around the Queens music scene, but like your version sounds like Last Call.
Ellie, was that your song suggestion? Maybe that was just one that we all kind of came together.
I think I heard it.
But that was one of the first songs that actually had sax in it,
right? Because we had found out that Nick was this incredible, amazing sax player. I was like, okay, how do we utilize this best? And we're like, okay, sax songs, Valerie was like one of the first ones that came to mind. I was like, this could be a great song for us.
So you were doing the Amy Winehouse, Mark Ronson version of it.
Yes.
Okay. And we're going to be hearing that right now on CFRC Radio.
All the things. hair and the way you dance. Oh, why don't you come on over? And I look across the water, and I think of all the things of what you're doing, and in my head I paint a picture. As soon as you come on home, well, my body's been a mess. Miss your ginger hair and the way you dress. Oh, why don't you come on over? Stop making a fool.
Last call, and that was us playing cover of Valerie by Amy Winehouse.
Wonderful. We've got people picking up the pieces. They're really getting ready to do radio stuff properly. Folks, we're having live on-air media training. This is great. But you've been listening to CFRC Radio. We are joined by Last Call this morning. We've been talking about Illapalooza. We've been talking about, like, your sounds and everything. And we're talking kind of at the end of March, beginning of April. This is kind of a confusing time for bands because it's like everyone gets kind of busy, people just dissipate and like go their own ways. What plans do you guys have like coming into September when your crowds are also going to be coming back?
I think I'm going to hop on the emails this summer. Hopefully we can come out swinging next September with some ideas for recording some things. And September will come back. Hopefully we'll have some shows right out of the gate while the sun is still shining before, you know, the winter blues hit again. And some originals possibly.
Yeah. I'm really curious to see how you're going to fit 7 people on that toucan stage.
Yeah, me too.
We thought the mansion was small.
We'll get some crowd engagement going. And
we all fit on this couch. An immersive experience.
People sitting on chairs.
But where can people find you guys? Like, do you have any socials you want to tell people to just follow you on and all that?
We got the Instagram at the band Last Call. Follow us on Instagram. We got a Kingston Live up. We've got all of our articles that we've been linked in our link tree in our bio. You can all get all the tickets on Instagram.
We have a TikTok as well.
Oh, we have a TikTok. Stay tuned. Content coming soon.
Studio behind the scenes coming soon as well, hopefully. But we have one last song before I finally like release you guys from this tiny little studio. What do we have? And tell us a bit about why you picked it.
I think that's got to go to Brendan.
Yeah. Well, this song, I was actually listening to it. I was looking to the whole album from the Backseat Lovers, Waiting to Spill. And I think it was pretty late. And I heard this one song and I kept replaying it. Then I instantly texted the group chat. I was like, please, please let us do this song. And everyone was kind of like, I don't know. Especially Leo. Like, he was like, no. But then after you listen to it a few times, you realize what a banger it is. So we pulled through. Nick hopped on sax for the song, and I cried. I was very happy we got to do it. This song is called Close Your Eyes.
By the Backseat Lovers, covered by Last Call. Thanks so much for joining us, guys. Is there anything else we need to tell our listeners before we go into your final song?
Stay tuned for September, because we'll be back and better than ever.
Amazing. Guys, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Do you want to be like your father? The older you get, your head's getting harder. Pick up the phone when he calls you. You know he's alone. He's preaching 'cause he loves you. Where have you been?
Call.
And you're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM.
Tune in Sundays at 11 p.m. for Orchestral Maneuvers After Dark with me, DJ Squared. Each episode features a great mix of new and vintage, Canadian and international, new wave, punk, post-punk, garage rock, pop, electronica, ambient, and even the occasional remix. Sweet beats are in store for all to enjoy. Join in the fun, OMD, every Sunday at 11 right here on CFRC 101.9 FM.
today from the Wings Archive.
How many times do we separate from each other because we don't want to do the work?
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world. Produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service. Bell Hooks died on December 15, 2021, at her home in Berea, Kentucky, at age 69. Many obituaries list her credentials, her influence, and her 30 or so books. People are posting favorite Bell Hooks quotes all over social media. Hooks is also justly famous for her blunt, clear, and loving lectures.
How many times do we separate from each other because we don't want to do the work of confronting? Because confronting may be bringing pain. How many times do white women and women of color say to me, well, you know, I just dropped out of this because I couldn't deal with those white women anymore. And yet, we will hang into relationships working with them. I said, how many of us have an intimate relationship where we never get angry? Where we never have impulses of rage? What we believe is that even in the midst of those impulses of anger or rage, it is our greater good, our collective feeling of care that will guide us. Why don't we feel the same thing in our movements? Why don't you feel the same thing at those meetings when you are locking heads with women of color and men of color over issues of difference? Around racism, around classism. Why don't bourgeois black women who are confronting working class women who say, you don't understand our issues, feel that same willingness to believe that the overall feeling of commitment and care can guide us through dissent, chaos, and crisis? Why do we allow those things to fall apart often? Why do we say, well, I won't try to do that anymore? You know, I had a young black bourgeois woman tell me, I went somewhere to help these women, you know, and they were just so hostile. And I said, well, did you think about the way you framed it? Did you think about the location that you were coming from? And why with one attempt are you willing to give up? Do you give up that way in the relationships of intimacy in your life? Don't we struggle in the midst of patriarchy? Don't many of you who are heterosexual struggle with men daily, believing and hoping eternally that you can bring some greater good to the situation? And yet we don't bring that same eternal hope and conviction to our movement.
From the Wings Archive, bits of wisdom from the late Bell Hooks.
What does it mean that people can see so much violence and yet be aware of it but not feel compelled to change it?
Bell Hooks addressing the Texas Council on Family Violence in 1993.
People like you, people like those feminist activists who began the battered women's movement, have been truly successful in that we now have a culture that fundamentally acknowledges the reality of violence against women. People really do acknowledge today, most people, that incest happens, that domestic battery happens. Even people who don't want to have anything positive to say about feminism will acknowledge these realities. The difficulty we face is how do we move that acknowledgement past mere recognition into the willingness to do something every day of your life to change violence? And that is what I do not see. I have never forgiven Donahue, our, you know, talk show liberal male feminist, for that moment on his show when Scheherazade Ali was on there saying that sometimes black women need to be hit in the mouth. And there was Haki Madhubuti from Third World Press saying, indeed, I don't sell her books in my store because they condone violence against black women. And Donahue fixed that camera on him and he said, that's censorship. And my class and I have looked at that moment and we've talked about how in that moment on national television, what Donahue actually did with his camera and with his symbolic power was to say, violence against women is not a real political issue. Now, censorship and free speech, that's a real political issue. Did many of you see the film Thelma and Louise? There is that moment in Thelma and Louise at the beginning that to me is so powerful, when the attempted rape has been interrupted. And I'm forgetting right now which one of them, Thelma or Louise, says to the violent, battering, abusive white male at that moment, when a woman is crying, she's not having a good time. And to me, that was one of those magical moments in cinema and in film where I felt that anybody looking at that moment could click. It could click. Like, you could get it. Like, wow. I suddenly realized that, in fact, when people are crying, often it signals perhaps that they're in pain, that they are sad, that something is wrong, that something is out of place. And I thought, this is the power of mass media, that it can make you feel for a moment something that can turn on that light bulb. But then I felt that what ultimately happened is the film then proceeded to undercut that moment throughout by making it seem like, well, guess what, world? Women are just as violent as men. Women are just as willing to humiliate men. Women will, you know, and I see this as a major theme running through how mass media is dealing with the issue of violence right now, saying things to us like, men may be violent, but women are so violent too. And if women only had the power men had, they would be just as violent. So I've been thinking a lot about the naturalization and the normalization of violence. What I think is happening in our culture is that people feel incredibly powerless to change it because they feel like it is normative. They feel like it is natural. I can't tell you how many people say to me that, don't you think the impulse to hit, or that's just a natural thing, and that's just how boys are going to be. And I think about all the incredible work we've done within feminist movement, within the movement of domestic violence, to try to undercut that, and the message has still not gotten across to people, that it is not normative, that it is not natural, the act of doing violence. I'm willing to even allow that the impulse can be talked about as a, quote, natural impulse. I've been feeling very violent myself lately. And in fact, I've written a piece called Killing Rage, because I feel deeply enraged about the things that are not changing in this society. I had an experience recently that was the subject of this essay, and I want to talk about it here because I want to talk about how racism within and without the movement to end domestic violence continues to keep us apart. I got on an airplane with a black woman friend, and we were seated together in first class. We had those upgrades. And she had not been given a boarding pass. We were sitting in our little seats, and another black woman got on, and a white male was sitting in her seat and refused to move. The black woman was very nice. She said, that's okay, I'll sit anywhere, da-da-da-da-da. And I have to say that even other fellow white passengers asked this man to move. He was obstinate that he would not move. Then a white man got on who had a boarding pass for the seat that my friend was sitting in. He came to our sides and said, you're sitting in my seat. And she said, oh no, I was given this seat. And then a few minutes later, she was called to the front of the plane. I said to her, don't move. She didn't listen to me. She moved. She went up, and it was explained to her that she was in this gentleman's seat. And while the stewardess were neatly negotiating our body space, he went and sat in the seat with her purse, with her belongings. Everybody was looking at us on the plane. We were the difficult, angry black women who were up there discussing this. And it was very clear that nothing was going to happen. And I went back to my seat. And Mr. Smiling Liberal White Man, no doubt a feminist man in his imagination, says to me, you know, he says, I'm so sorry. It's unfortunate, but, you know, I didn't really have anything, you know, to do with this. I said, don't tell me you're sorry. You watched her being humiliated. You watched them call her up to the front of this plane. And you didn't say, there's no need for humiliation here. I'm willing to sit elsewhere. Or you didn't say, I want my seat because I've been assigned to it, but I don't like what's taking place here. I don't condone what's taking place here. I said, no, that seat was so important to you. And he had that little grin of, I didn't let those, you know, wild black women, you know, get my seat. He had triumphed. And I felt rage towards him. And I'm going to be honest with you, if I could have killed him, I would have. And I don't say that lightly, and I don't say that. It didn't amuse me. I was scared that I felt that his refusal to see how racism and sexism work in this society and classism welled up in me so much that I felt murderous rage. And I'm telling you that everybody around me knew that I felt murderous rage because it was coming out of my pores. And I had never felt that in my life before. And it was one of those things where on one level it was trivial, but deep within me, it was like all those incidences of a failure to understand difference and solidarity and what it means. And I just began to weep intensely. Because I felt that why are we still having to deal with this? Why aren't people more aware? And I got out my pen and I began to write this essay that was called Killing Rage, Moving from Pain to Power. Because I feel that we have to hone our rage. We have to use it as a tool for vision and insight and understanding. This essay is a fine piece of work that came out of that rage. And I think that when we try to suppress our rage, it's when the dilemmas in our lives start. But one of the things that I've been thinking about, and I wanted to say, I also felt estranged from the black woman friend that I was with. I thought, why did she choose them over me? Why didn't she listen to me when I told her not to move from her seat? And I thought, why am I so angry at this injustice, and she seems to be more willing to conform? And at the end of the plane, I waited for her. And all these people came out, and all of a sudden I heard these voices screaming and yelling. And she came out and she was in this intense battle with the stewardesses about racism and sexism. Because what had happened to her is when she went back to take the seat they said was hers, a white family was sitting there with their children. And do you know what they asked her? Would you be willing to give up your seat so this family can sit together? And she gave up her seat because she felt like she didn't really have any stake in the seat. But it enraged her that at no point was that white man asked, would he be willing to give up his seat so we could be together? Would he be willing to give up his seat so we wouldn't have to be humiliated publicly? In fact, he was invested in our humiliation. And I know that many of you out there have had these same struggles around race on your jobs, with the projection onto black women and black people in general that we are too angry, that we want something for nothing, that we disrupt the harmony of gatherings with our critiques. People tell me all the time, I'm just so tired of hearing black people talk about racism. You know, and that right there makes me get angry. You tired of hearing people talk about racism? We are tired of experiencing racism. And we are tired of the ignorance about the connection between violence against women and the violence of racism and classism, because they converge. And I think that those of us who work around these issues, see how they converge within us. I mean, look at the movement for domestic violence in this society. It has been a movement traditionally dominated by white women at the top and women of color as the victims, the people coming for services. That's how many people perceive of it. So what happens then when revolutionary, insightful women of color and black women come into such a movement and want to shake things up and want to deal with issues in a different way? We know what happens: confusion, anger, hostility, an end to discussion. I mean, the three words that I kept thinking about today in relation to talking to you was courage, challenge, commitment, forwards, and confrontation. Because I think that part of why we have not furthered our will to end violence in this society is we are afraid of confrontation. We are afraid of the violent feelings we have in ourselves towards one another within this movement. I said this morning to a group of black women I was talking to, I believe that white women have tremendous feelings of violence towards black women. The sense that black women need to be silenced, that we're too uppity, that we need to be closed down in some way. I see that same spirit of violence in black men often. Close these black women down. Shut them up. They're getting out of order. They're trying to take over. I said to my sisters this morning, how many times do I go to give a talk where a white woman says to me, there's a black woman in my office and she's just so angry. She's, you know, we really want to work with her, but she's just so difficult. And this happens again and again and again. And I think, my God, haven't white women read our literature? Don't they understand the roots of this anger? You know, we used to think, and I think this is one of the things that's plaguing feminist movement and the movement to end domestic violence. We used to think that if you just put the knowledge in front of people, people would change. And what we find is knowledge does not in and of itself change people. People are altered through practice, through experiences, because you can have all the knowledge of something up here in your head. I can't tell you how many white women I encounter daily who have knowledge, book knowledge of racism, but who don't understand how they manipulate in meetings or what have you, with silence, with smiles. You know, people, my students used to say, always say that if black women are talking rapidly, loud, aggressively, they see that as negative action. But if a white woman is talking a lot and she's smiling and she's quiet, they don't see her as potentially occupying space, asserting power, because we think of power differently. Last night we had a deep discussion, Joe, Sheila, Judy, and I, about the question of differences and commonalities. And I couldn't sleep because I was thinking about this discussion, because it does seem to me that women all over the world share commonalities in our suffering. That when we suffer at the hands of patriarchy, at the hands of male violence, there is nothing unique and special about the form and nature that our suffering takes. It is common. The problem becomes the reality of that shared suffering does not mediate the differences, the different ways we understand that pain. A black woman who may be battered by a black man but who feels that she can't call a white police structure. That may be very different from a white woman who feels like, well, you've got to call that structure, who doesn't understand that moment of hesitation, that reflection about what it means. You know, the commonality that black men and black women share, we share commonly the suffering to end racism. And yet, I talk to black men daily who say to me, they go on and on about white supremacy, and I say to them, but what about the issues confronting black women? And they'll say to me, well, black women are in cahoots with white men. And suddenly, there's a gendered reading of the experience of racism which says black men suffer more. And somehow black women are getting away with a lot. And I think this is so sad given the reality of our experience. Why can't they recognize the different ways black women suffer? I hear black men and black people tell me all the time, well, you know, black men, if black men are violent towards black women and children, it's because the man is on them, because white supremacy is just hurting them so much. And I said, I don't buy that. White supremacy is hurting black women every day of our lives. But many of us do not go home and shoot and kill and maim and mutilate and beat. So what does that mean? You know, I have had to look back at my mother, who worked as a maid for white people. And when she came home from her little jobs, she used to be so bubbly and full of joy. And as a child, I had no idea that there might have been some violence to her spirit. spirit and herself and her humanity on that job. It never occurred to me to think about white female violent assaults on the personhood of black women, because the way she came home never suggested that I've just been denigrated. I've just been told to eat my little sandwich in the kitchen after I have prepared an elegant meal for the white family. She never conveyed any sense of what was done to her in that setting that might have made it extra hard for her to come home and be bubbly and share her little treats and give us that sense that all was right with our world. And what that says to me is that there is something within us that can handle our impulses to be violent, that can transform that rage into a generosity of spirit, love, and care. And if black women are capable of making that leap, then black men must be capable of making that same leap. And we must not buy into any structure that tells us that somehow black male violence against women is justified because of the pain black men experience at the hand of white racism. One of the things that we stayed up late into the night debating was the question of female violence against children. We were in disagreement about the enormity and the intensity of that and whether it was akin to male violence against women and children. Those of you who know my work, who've read my chapter on violence and feminist theory from margin to center, know that I am of that school that believes that part of the problem we have in ending violence is that so many women believe that violence is an acceptable means of social control. Even if they don't believe it is acceptable in their personal lives, they may feel that it's acceptable in the world beyond their lives. They may see young people like those young black females we saw on Donahue who would kill people. And the white women in that audience had no trouble standing up saying they should be locked away forever, that their lives should be taken away, that they should be punished beyond all belief. That's an endorsement of violence. But it's the notion of the acceptable violence, the violence that makes us safe, that makes us feel good. Part of what I feel we have to confront is how can we enable people to see the interlocking nature of violence? So many white women and other groups of women can be against the violence of sexism, but have no trouble with the violence of racism, have no trouble actively assaulting other people of color, verbal assault, when it's in their interest to do so.
On Wings, excerpts from Bell Hooks' keynote address to the Texas Council on Family Violence in 1993. She went on to deconstruct a current sitcom that normalized rejection of black women and transvestites, and a recent film that created entertainment from the slaughter of a black gay man and a Korean couple.
I live on a corner that has a Korean grocer. I had never witnessed any kind of negative encounter between black youth and those store owners. But once that film came into being, every time I went in, it's not so much that people look at violence and think that it's not wrong. They may look at it and think that it's wrong, but it's so exciting. It's so pleasurable. It's more intense and more fulfilling than any kind of effort towards nonviolence could ever be. I think that this is a deep and profound moment. How do we intervene on that seduction of violence? I had to ask myself, I watch a lot of films. Would I 10 years ago have wanted to kill that white man on the plane? Or would I have believed that with my Christianity of that time, with everything, I could convert him? Why was my immediate impulse so deeply violent? And I think it has to do with the intimacy of violence in all our lives, the normative nature of it, the way it creeps up in all our interactions. I want to close by saying that I thought a lot about why have we been so afraid of facing that violence within ourselves that comes up. Black female hatred and anger towards white women, the violence that comes up in these meetings. The violence when you just feel like, I wish I could go over and slap her. I wish I could pull her hair. I wish I could make her understand. Is that violence so radically different from the violence a batterer feels?
I was talking on the phone and I found that this boyfriend of mine that I'm breaking up with had told me another lie, and I kept thinking, I wish I could beat him to death with this telephone. I wish I could just start pounding on him with this telephone so I could make him understand that this is serious. You know, I talked to my sister the other day, and her child had done something that was deeply upsetting, lied, disobeyed, gone out, left the door open, all of these things that potentially placed her in danger as a young woman in a large urban city in a poor neighborhood. And I said, well, what did you do? She said, I beat her. I had to beat her. I had to make her understand. And I said to her, but do you remember when Mama used to beat us to make us understand? And did we understand? Did the light go off? Did the magic happen for us that I've been beaten and I understand? You know? But what saddened me was I felt that she, and when we talked about it, the enormity of her feeling of powerlessness. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to do to make her understand the seriousness of this situation. That she could have been raped. That she could have been battered. That the other children whom she left in the house with the door open could have been hurt. I didn't know how to make her understand the seriousness of that. So that I think that we are so bombarded right now with that tragic dimension, that tragic feeling of powerlessness. And it's interesting because she said to me that, you know, I'm going to find a therapist for her. And I said to her, but you know, you may have to find a therapist for yourself to find out what is a more productive way I can intervene on this situation. I mean, this is a woman who has honed her feminist insights. A working class woman in America who has grown, who has broken out of the sexism in her domestic household, who has resisted. And yet, when faced with a situation of crisis, she falls back on those things that we always learn were the way to handle something and to make people understand. I think feminism has failed tremendously in our capacity to provide people with concrete ways that they can transform situations and concrete ways that we can enable people to understand. And I think that this is the task before us. And we cannot meet that task if we are not willing to vigilantly interrogate the violence in ourselves.
Bell Hooks, from her address to the 12th Annual Conference of the Texas Council on Family Violence in October 1993. This brilliant and extremely influential thinker died in December 2021. Her ideas live on. Wings is a weekly half-hour radio series covering the global women's movement and related issues, and distributed free of charge to community radio stations around the world. For more information, email wings@wings.org. Supporters in 2021 include community radio stations WERU and KMUD, Carolyn Byerly, the Women's Institute for Freedom of the Press, the International Association of Women in Radio and Television, U.S. Chapter, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, author of the book The Gift in the Heart of Language, The Maternal Source of Meaning, and whose recent series of events can be viewed at